This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.
A so-called devoted mom, Lindsay Clancy, her three tots found strangled dead with mommy's exercise bands tonight, her secret diary. Good evening. I'm Nancy Grace. This is Crime Stories. I want to thank you for being with us. Mommy's exercise bands were used to strangle the three children.
She was aware of some of the troubles Lindsay was having, and she was aware that Lindsay was having maybe some darker thoughts. And then when asked on the stand, was Lindsay Clancy emotional? She said, no, there were no tears.
147 Summers Street, responding with the police. The old party jumped off the top floor of the house. She did slice her wrist as well, and neck injuries, neck laceration. She's conscious at this time. We're going to check with med flight. It was over a 20-foot fall.
It's unknown where the knife is, or whatever she used to slit her. She's in the, looks like they're pinging around the back. We'll get that info now.
She did use a knife at first, unknown where that is at this time. I'm on the way. We're with the county.
I got two pediatric arrests to make.
Mom has the two pediatric arrests. We got a mutual aid on the way. Mutual aid at this time.
You're hearing part of the 911 dispatch call after three little tots, one an infant, all found strangled dead by mommy with her own exercise bands. Now, we all know the stretchy nature of exercise bands or bungee cords. Imagine the force and exertion required. It's like strangling someone with a rubber band. How hard she had to pull the exercise cords in order to murder her own children. And tonight we find out that one of the first things that comes out of her mouth when she's in the hospital, she's taken off the ventilator, she says, "Do I have a lawyer?" Okay. Straight out to Randy Kessler joining us, veteran trial lawyer, professor at the Emory Law School, former chair of the ABA Family Law Section for the entire American Bar Association, author of Divorce, Protect Yourself, Your Kids, and Your Future. Randy, the reason I am emphasizing the force and exertion necessary to strangle not one, two, but three children, one of whom we believe ran in fear to his father's basement office, the older boy. There you see Callum there. He's just an infant. Is akin to, the reason I'm bringing it up is because you and I have argued that on different sides of the fence, of course, in court when it comes to the force necessary to pull a trigger. Remember, we just had that come up in court with a veteran and well-known lawyer in your jurisdiction that shot his wife dead, and he said it was an accident. Said that he was sleeping and woke up and went, oop, bam, and killed his wife. Yeah, that did not work for me. The point is the force and exertion used to pull a trigger goes to intent. And here we have it, intent times three. The force necessary to use those elastic bands to pull them so tightly as they were stretchy and giving. That takes a lot of force, a lot of exertion, and a lot of time during which she could have formed intent. Kessler, do you agree with me? You know the law as well as I do. That intent to commit a crime, any crime, does not require a long period of planning. Intent can be formed, as our former judge would say, Luther Alverson, in the blink of an eye, the twinkling of a moment, in the time it takes you to raise a gun and pull the trigger, much less the time it takes you to pull and pull and pull exercise bands to kill them. That's time to form intent.
Yes, she had the time to form a tent. She had that intent, and she killed her children. But the question, my opening statement and my closing argument would be, she did this because. That's the only question the defense can rely on, which is, now I know motive's not a question in front of this jury, but she did this because, and the jury's going to fill that answer, that blank in with, she was crazy, she was psychotic, she was mentally insane, because there's no other answer to that question. She did this because, why? She wanted out of the marriage, she wanted, there was no other answer that makes as much sense as, she did this because she was not mentally capable of making the right decision. That's the only defense that the defense has.
Randy Kessler, could you hold up your sign again, please? I'd like to see that.
You like my artwork?
Okay, I'm very impressed. Okay, I'm impressed that you had your assistant print that out. Straight out to Penny Commit joining us, Boston investigative reporter, WBZ, CBS Boston, has covered multiple high-profile cases, including this one. Penny Commit, thank you for being with us. I'm going to get into all the facts, but answer me this. Riddle me this, Penny. One of the first things that came out of her mouth when she came to and they removed the breathing device was about a lawyer. Isn't that true? What did she say?
So one of her doctors testified that she was actually writing answers on a piece of paper because she had all these tubes in her mouth. She was hooked up to all these different pieces of equipment. And she wrote that she felt horrified. And then she asked, where is her family? And then one of the first things she did ask is, do I need a lawyer? And that is something that the jurors heard last week.
Okay, you are seeing a shot of Lindsey Clancy in the hospital. And the reason I'm showing this, Kessler, to your delight, she is definitely battered and bruised. She is paralyzed from her jump from her second story window. Some would argue, let's see the shot of the window sill, that blood on the outer edge of the window sill, it's blurred right there, that's a state's exhibit, shows that she hung on trying to lessen her fall. Her arms were bleeding. Does that indicate she tried to hold on to lessen her fall? But back to the hospital. Kessler, I'm sure you're going to have a field day with this. Let me see, Kessler, please. And Randy, I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm not saying that she was not in postpartum psychosis. I know it's so incredibly rare, and because she immediately asked for a lawyer, and I'm glad Penny Commit told us how she communicated, because it takes a lot more effort to write something than it does to just blurt it out. So she actually had the wherewithal to write lawyer. I mean, wait, Penny Commit, did she ask anything about her children?
She asked where her family is and if she can have visitors, but that's all the witness testified to.
Where is my family? Did she say, did I kill the children? Did they survive? Where are my babies? Anything like that?
The doctor did not testify that she wrote down any of those.
So that would be a no.
Correct. She wrote, I feel horrified. Can I have visitors? Where is my family? And then, do I need a lawyer?
Okay, hold on, Kessler. Hold on just a moment. Susan Constantine joining me, body language expert, jury consultant. Wow. Author of 5 books, including How to Spot a Liar in 7 Seconds or Less. Okay, Susan, I'm not a nonverbal expert like you are, but I did notice that every sentence Penny Commit just said relating what Clancy stated had either I or me or my in it.
Yeah, so I near my is someone that is very conscious about themselves. But you know, there's a lot of research that's behind those that use I, me, and my a lot that are very self-absorbed. But also people that do that have high levels of depression because they're always self-conscious. But the fact that she was concerned more about herself, not so much about the children and not really asking about her children is problematic. So the first words that come out of her mouth is telling you what she's cognitively thinking. And the other thing is I want to make a point to is that her reasoning obviously was intact, that she could come out of this situation and actually ask a question or write a question about her. And it just shows that she was able to reason. And that really creates some issues for me.
So Susan Constantine, wait a minute. It's like you want your cake on your plate and you want to eat it too. So you want to say, My is a sign of a narcissistic, possibly sociopath. On the other hand, it could mean she's really, really depressed. Okay, you're going to have to pick a side here because I need guidance. I need to understand what's happening because you and I, we all know that when it comes to postpartum psychosis, only 1 to 2 women per 1,000 actually have psychosis. A lot of women have postpartum depression, and it can be debilitating. But postpartum psychosis means you don't really even know what you're doing. By the way, that video from our friend Nate Eaton at East Idaho News. So pick a side, Constantine. I need guidance. And that was a little wishy-washy.
Okay, so I'm going to share with you what the research says, okay? Dr. James Pennebaker wrote a book about the secret life of pronouns. He talked a lot about the I, me, and my. The I, me, and my are taking personal ownership. Generally speaking, that it's about them. They're asking, this is them taking personal ownership. But on the flip side of that, what we found in the research is that people that consistently use I, me, and my are very self-aware. They're when you talk about narcissistic personality disorder, but so it's not one or the other, Nancy, it's both.
Penny Commit joining us, investigative reporter, WBZ, CBS Boston. What was in her journal?
You know what's funny? And this is how it goes every trial, right? The prosecution and the defense focus on very different things when it came to that journal. The prosecution focused on how Lindsay was exhausted. She was saying how she desperately needs a break. At one point, she wrote in her journal that she feels like she needs a break so badly that her brain is making her body sick. She said, "My mind never shuts off." She said, "I feel disconnected with my baby. I'm so desperate for a mental break from taking care of everyone." And they focused on, you know, her meticulously documenting her children's sleep schedules. They're trying to show that she was a controlling mother. The defense, on the other hand, and this goes back to her defense attorney, Kevin Reddington, it seems he's taking this case very personally. He reads an excerpt from the diary where she says, "I want to be well." And his voice even choked up when he read that. He mentions how she wrote she has horrible insomnia, anxiety, it's causing depression. "I want help. I want to be well." And that was a big moment for the jurors to hear.
Randy Kessler, I want you to hear what Dr. Todd Barr has to say. Dr. Barr joining us out of Ohio, forensic pathologist, deputy coroner of Franklin County. That's Columbus. Never a lack of business in the Columbus morgue.
Correct.
Featured That's in right. Thin Places, Essays from In Between. Dr. Barr, I hear a lot in this case. And again, I want the truth. I don't want a witch hunt where she is put behind bars when she truly was in psychosis. On the other hand, I don't want her hiding behind a psychosis claim when she formed intent and committed 3 murders on her children. Why? I don't care why. I've noticed that when a woman is on trial for murder, specifically murder of her children, people search, scour for a motive. It doesn't matter. They're dead. She's alive. No one talks about the children.
Yeah.
Nobody. Have you ever heard in the analyses of this case someone talk about what the 3 children went through before their deaths, how they were lured to the basement by mommy, who orchestrated her husband leaving home to go to the furthest away restaurant, a restaurant they had never gotten takeout from before, ever, then sent him to, I think it was CVS Pharmacy, to get a prescription, waited for him to leave to kill the children. There he is wandering around the CVS looking for whatever the prescription was, which in my world, shows intent and premeditation. Dr. Barr, back to what the children went through. We have reason to believe they were put face down and strangled from behind, which is a whole other can of worms for our shrink, Dr. Leslie Dobson. But that one of the children, the oldest boy, actually tried to run. That would be Dawson. He was found dead in his father's office, which was also in the basement. What did they endure? What does a human endure when they are strangled, much less face down from behind by their mother, who is tightly gripping exercise bands to kill them?
Absolute, unmitigated terror is what they went through. It may have only lasted for a number of minutes. It takes about 10 to 15 seconds of pressure on the carotid arteries and the jugular veins to prohibit blood flow to and from the brain, which is what causes the hypoxia or the lack of oxygen to the brain. They would become quite dizzy, quite obtunded almost immediately. And within, you know, in a typical adult, 4 to 5 minutes of lack of oxygen would lead to irreversible brain damage. So anything more than 4 minutes of a ligature around the neck that's occluding these veins and arteries of the neck is going to render them incapacitated within minutes. I know that the 8-month-old survived a period of 3 days, so I'm not sure what the mechanism there was, if she didn't use as much force on the infant so that the baby was able to survive for a period of days. But the other three, it takes about 4 to 6 pounds of pressure to close off the jugular veins because they're very thin. It takes about 7 to 11 pounds of pressure to close off the carotid arteries. A light banded exercise band has a tensile strength of between 5 and 15 pounds. And as you stretch those, Nancy, and I know you were referencing how she's got to pull and pull and pull to tighten these exercise bands. But as you stretch them, they naturally want to recoil. So she's actually being assisted by the elasticity of the exercise bands to create additional force on the neck. And these are small children. So we usually talk in terms of adults when we use these pressures and time frames, but you have to imagine these kids are much smaller than adults, and it would be much easier to cut off their oxygen supply with an exercise band. So to answer your question, in the end, they had several minutes of just sheer panic.
What happens to the body and the mind when you are being asphyxiated? Do you just pass out? You don't feel anything? Because in my experience of prosecuting manual and ligature strangulations, I've seen scratches where the victim herself scratches,
yes,
at her own throat, trying to get the band off, just like deep furrowed scratches. I know that the petechia in the eyes burst. What does that feel like for your blood vessels in your eyes to blow up?
Yeah.
Struggling for air? Do you just, right, everything goes black and you don't feel anything? What actually happens? What happened to these three children?
Yeah, you know, and like I said, again, it's absolute terror, and you're correct. We see this very often in ligature or manual strangulations where the victim naturally. It's just an innate ability or an innate mechanism to survive, that they would reach up and try to pull whatever the offensive element is off of their neck so that they can breathe. I mean, that's just, that's getting into your animal brain, your reptilian brain. And the when the blood vessels are bursting and causing petechia, that would feel like a burning sensation because you've got the blood is leaking out through and causing these red dots to form all over the face, in the oral mucosa, in the mucosa of the eyes, the conjunctiva, and all of that. It would feel like a sunburn almost, that you're getting this burning sensation.
To Randy Kessler, hearing the premeditation, the planning, and what the children endured, and I've seen this in court a million times. Defense attorneys do their very best so the jury doesn't hear what the victims went through. There is no victim in the courtroom. All the jury sees is the defendant. This defendant is paralyzed from the waist down, from jumping out of her window. So they are seeing her looking sympathetic. And I think what happened to the children is getting lost in the sauce, Randy. But I want to hear your response to the effort it took to strangle the children, and that some of her first communications were, do I have a lawyer? Not, did my children live? How are my children? What have I done to my children? Is this a horrible dream? Are they dead? Are they alive? But do I have a lawyer? I find that to be troublesome, to say the least.
And combined with the horrific nature of the murder, no question about it. But all of those facts, Nancy, are prejudicial, not probative. Those facts don't need to be said. They're being said to play on the sympathy of the jury. The question, the issue of whether she did this has been answered. She's acknowledged it. She's admitted it. Her lawyer said she did it. Whether she did it and it caused a lot of pain or little pain, it's horrible. But they're emphasizing how much pain it caused these children, how horrible it was, to get the jury more sympathetic to the victims and more likely to want to punish the mother. But that's not the legal standard. The legal question here is not how bad was it, how much did they suffer. The question is, did she do it because she had a mental break, because she was in a state of psychosis? And none of the questions you're raising, none of the issues you're bringing up, mitigate or change the fact that if she did it, it was because she was under a state of psychosis. There's no other reason. She did not hate the husband.
That is absolutely not correct, Kessler. Because if she could create a plan, intent, and then carry out the intent, that goes to presence of mind. It goes to frame of mind, course of conduct, so many more aspects that are probative at trial. I appreciate your attempt. Maybe the defense attorney can learn from what you just said. Joining us now, Dr. Leslie Dobson, clinical forensic psychologist, host of a brand new podcast on iHeart, Intentionally Disturbing. And you can find her at drlesliedobson.com, author of The Friend Cleanse, How to Set Boundaries with Energy Vampires. Dr. Leslie, weigh in.
I think she was floridly psychotic, and you cannot convince me otherwise. We have a violence-free history, a happy mother, and she faked going to all these doctors, getting all these medications, faked being completely insane, faked having all of this anxiety, faked suicidal thoughts and harm for her children, then all of a sudden premeditated, killed her three kids and jumped out a window and wanted to be paralyzed. It makes no sense. And there is no way the prosecution is going to be able to convince a jury to say without doubt that there was no question of insanity.
Well, of course, that's not the legal standard, Dr. Leslie. The standard is beyond a reasonable doubt, not no doubt, beyond a reasonable doubt.
Well, it's two prongs in Massachusetts.
And they are?
The two prongs are that we need clear and convincing evidence. So do we have doubt? And do we actually believe that she was sane or insane at the time of the crime?
Actually, in Boston and throughout Massachusetts, as in the rest of the country, the legal standard of proof in a criminal trial is beyond a reasonable doubt. That is the standard, beyond a reasonable doubt, not a fanciful doubt, but a reasonable doubt based in reason, not to a mathematical certainty such as 2 and 2 equals 4, but beyond a reasonable doubt. Dave Mack, what can you tell me about the facts that we are learning in the courtroom? The big question tonight is she going to take the stand? Dave Mack, Crime Stories investigative reporter, jump in.
Nancy, what we have found out in court is that Lindsey Clancy at least planned the events of the day enough. Early on, if you remember, early on, Lindsey Clancy texted Patrick about getting dinner from a takeout place, didn't say which one, but that was early in the day. Are you in for takeout later on? So the plan begins then. Then when it comes time to send Patrick Clancy away from the home, Lindsey Clancy orders the takeout from a restaurant they've never used before and that is the furthest away from their home, but still realistic to possibly use. Then she adds going by CVS to pick up some medication. Patrick Clancy is confused and calls Lindsey Clancy while he's at CVS, Nancy. And the reason I'm pointing this out is that Lindsey Clancy got Patrick away from the home and was planning to do that earlier in the day. Then she's in the middle of whatever is taking place when Patrick calls. And you know what? He says, she just sounded like she was a little active, but nothing really going on. She's in the middle of killing her children, and yet she can be normal with Patrick on the phone. So as this all starts to break down, we also realize that you mentioned was Dawson the boy. Was he trying to escape? Well, we have Callan and Cora both found in the same area of the basement. Dawson was found across the room in an office that Patrick Clancy was using to work from home. But you know, Nancy, the bands were tied so differently around Dawson's neck that the bands were not pulled off by Patrick as easy as the other ones, where he had to pull it out above, around his Dawson's head. So this was a plan of action that Lindsey Clancy factored in all day long to get her husband out of the house and to stay gone long enough for her to do what she wanted to do. That's perfect planning.
To Susan Constantine joining us out of the Orlando jurisdiction. You've seen her in many, many high-profile trials. She's a body language expert. It has been reported that Clancy sent secret clues during the trial, particularly when her husband was on the stand. Did you notice them? And what, if anything, can you make of it?
Okay. So, you know, in my world, we don't go A plus B equals C. There's got to be some sort of correlation. So we don't know what we don't know. So I think that that's really far reaching to say that she was sending clues, because we don't know. So on the other hand, what we're seeing, though, we're seeing a lot of emotion, mostly within the mouth. We see a lot of the lip-lipping. We see a lot of the lip rolling. All of that is all a physiological response from stress, right? It doesn't mean she's withholding information, because she wasn't going to speak. So to say that she's like literally putting a cup over her mouth and refusing to say something is ridiculous. Okay. There's no research to back that up. What we do know is that when somebody is stressed, okay, there's high cognitive load, it dries up the salivary glands, and then that's why they lick their lips. The other reason why they press their lips together could be all kinds of reasons. They're restraining, they're pressing down, they're trying to contain their emotions, and you'll see it around their mouth because there's 20 muscles around the mouth. So that's why we see all of this movement. The other thing I'd like to speak to about the tears. People can cry with tears and not have the nose drip, and vice versa. Again, there's no research that the two have to happen simultaneously. But what it does tell us is about the level of emotion that somebody's feeling. So when the level of emotion is really high, you might see more tears with the snot, okay? So let's just clear that up, because sometimes I hear stuff and it really aggravates me because I think it's a bunch of pseudoscience baloney. I strictly go by what does the research say, and then also assign it to what the context and their baseline and their behavior at that exact moment.
What is face blocking, lip rolling, and billboard eyebrows?
Okay, so billboard eyebrows is just a term that is saying that your forehead is where we show a lot of our emotion. Okay, so it's not just there, it's actually in your mouth too. So it's not just the forehead. So if they raise their eyebrows, show fear, the white above the eyes, they might do a confirmation glance or a surprise glance in the forehead. So you see the eyebrows lift up. If somebody's feeling sadness, you see those grief muscles, and then this will pull up. So if she's feeling sad, then you may see that. Also, if the brows lower or pinch together, could be anger, could be concentration, could be frustration. So you start to see there's no one size fits all. There are different emotions that a person is feeling. And then we also have what we call complex emotions. So you can have an array of emotions in the exact same moment. And I think that's what we're seeing here is complex emotions.
To Penny Commit joining us, investigative reporter, WBZ, CBS Boston. What of her behavior stands out in court? And do you believe Clancy will risk taking the stand?
Oh, Nancy, I would be highly surprised if she took the stand. Her defense attorney is one of the most well-renowned, best defense attorneys in Massachusetts. He has covered so many high-profile cases. His witness list is extensive. He has so many people that he is ready to have testify. I would be shocked if he would risk her taking the stand with his level of expertise. But never say never. It certainly happened before in criminal trials, even here in Massachusetts. And when it comes to her body language, when we heard from the medical examiner that performed an autopsy on her youngest son, Callan, she was crying so hard that you could hear it, not only me sitting in the courtroom, but I had people telling me they could hear it through the live stream. She was wailing, audibly sobbing. Once that medical examiner was done on the stand, the judge actually called a surprise break. I assume because Lindsey Clancy was so beside herself and she was wheeled out of the courtroom, and we didn't come back to testimony until maybe about 15, 20 minutes later.
From our friends at East Idaho News, straight out now to Crime Stories investigative reporter Dave Mack. Dave, I would say it's about 50-50 on the trials that you and I have covered and the trials that I investigated and prosecuted, which are now between that up in the thousands. I very often see a killer break down and cry. I never know if they're sorry they did it or they're sorry they got caught. So she's seeing autopsy photos of her three children and probably seeing them for the first time. And it must be very upsetting to think they died at her hand. So the sobbing and the crying and the hiding her face, I really don't know what to make of that, because they're dead. I don't care how much she cries now. They're dead, and she did it. And I'm only trying to find out, was she in a psychotic break at the time she did it? It's very difficult, and we have to look at the truth. Whether that makes us public enemy number one and we get more death threats, what is the truth of it? I mean, she clearly formed intent, Dave Mack. She clearly formed intent by sending her husband out and waiting for him to be gone to murder the children. But can you form intent when you're in psychosis? What else jumps out at you specifically about the crying in court?
The crying in court makes perfectly good sense to me because, you know, she is seeing her children, and she's hearing about what took place with them in terms of their autopsies, and she's upset and crying because they are her children. I don't think she's thinking of it, well, I did this. I don't think that at all. I think she's like upset because her children are on display for all the world to see and that, you know, they're gone. But Nancy, I really have a lot of trouble with the fact that we have a woman who weeks earlier checked herself in for a psychiatric evaluation for a few days and was so concerned about her well-being that she did that. But she also checked herself out without doctors wanting her to do that. You know, she checked herself out and then went on with her life. And, you know, I don't know psychosis, but I do know this. Those children are dead at her hand, and she had enough wherewithal to plan it out. So the fact that they're gone and she's not leaves us with, well, what was her intent? I mean, there were better ways for her to kill herself if that was her goal. But ultimately, she planned it, she carried it out, and does it really matter? You know, at a certain point in time, you know, I don't think you get to play that, well, I was in psychosis. I'm sorry, Nancy. Three children are dead that shouldn't be. And she made sure the one person that could protect them was far enough away from home that he couldn't protect his children.
Is that you entering the store?
Yeah.
And that section you head to on the right, is that the pediatric medication section?
Yeah.
Okay. And while you're in that section, looking for the medication, do you do something?
I called Lindsay.
And why did you call Lindsay?
Because what we were looking for wasn't there.
What did you do once you got inside the home?
I started taking my boots off.
Was there anything you noticed?
Yeah, the house is really quiet.
Is that unusual?
Yeah.
And when you realized it was really quiet, what did you do?
I called out.
And who did you call out to?
Everyone.
Did anyone answer?
No. I saw Cora.
And how did she look?
She had a band around her neck.
And was that an exercise band?
Yeah.
And do you recall whether she was, what position she was in, whether face up or face down?
She's face down.
And when you saw her in that condition, what did you do?
I immediately ran over and tried to take the band off.
Were you able to get the band off?
Yeah.
Was she responsive?
No. I saw Callan.
And where was he?
He was next to her.
And how did he appear?
He had a band around his neck.
Sorry?
He had a band around his neck.
And did you remove that as well?
Yeah.
And do you recall what position he was in?
Same as Cora.
After you removed the band from Callan's neck, what did you do next?
I tried to find Dawson.
And where did you go?
I looked in the bathroom and on the other side of the couch. And then I went to the other side of the basement and he was in my office.
And when you saw Dawson, what condition was he in?
I knew he was gone.
And did he also have a band around his neck?
Yeah.
And did you remove that band?
Yeah.
From our friends at East Idaho News, straight out now to Penny Commit joining us, investigative reporter WBZ, CBS Boston. There has been a, let me say, for airwaves, a sandstorm, a tempest after the prosecutor in this case was caught on a hot mic. Reportedly, when Clancy was crying loudly in court, saying, shut her up. Did that happen?
Well, this was probably the spiciest moment we have seen throughout this trial when defense attorney Kevin Reddington brought this up to the judge. The judge said, let's talk about this at sidebar. He goes, no, I want to talk about this right now. It was a big moment. And he accused the prosecutors of saying, shut her up. After, as I mentioned earlier, that medical examiner testified to the autopsy photos and Lindsay Clancy was crying hysterically. When you go back and listen to it, it's really hard to hear what they're actually saying. We, of course, reached out to the courts, asked what their response to this is. They said that they were telling the court clerks and the court officers to shut it off, referring to the photos of the autopsy that were on the screens for the jurors. It's one of those things that when you listen to it back, whatever you're listening for is kind of what you hear. So it's not totally clear if they said shut her up because she was crying or if they really did say shut it off. It's murky, but the judge said he will not have any commentary or disrespect in his courtroom, and then the trial moved on.
So the judge said he will not have disrespect in his courtroom. I couldn't quite hear you. What?
He seemed like he wanted to just lay the ground rules, no extra commentary, no any frivolous chatter, and moved on with the trial.
Guys, take a listen to what we're talking about in court. Okay, I didn't hear it. I heard shh. So, do we believe that's what she said? Yes or no? Straight out to you, Ms. Commit.
Oh, it's so hard to say. I mean, the prosecution gave their rebuttal. The defense had made a scene of it. Regardless, the defense is trying to stick up for his client.
So, to Dr. Leslie Dobson joining us, star of a new podcast on iHeart, Intentionally Disturbing, and author, clinical forensic psychologist, weigh in on what you're hearing.
I'm hearing a bunch of bullshit. I mean, if you don't understand what psychosis is, you shouldn't be speaking. I don't know what lawyer you had call in, but if you know nothing about altruistic filicide, you should not be commenting on this case. And she did check herself into
her
a hospital at 3
Put
in the morning.
Her up. I beg
she
your pardon. Do you think the people on the jury
so
have a forensic clinical psychology degree like you do? The lawyer
that
called in is joining us. He is a veteran trial lawyer who wins cases in court and does not misstate the legal standard of the law. I never agree with him, but he knows what he's talking about. So
no, he doesn't. He doesn't know what McNeil is.
Yes,
he does not know what psychosis is. He just said he didn't know what psychosis was.
Well, that's not his expertise, but I can tell you this much. He and I both know what a jury's going to do. Now, I'm asking you about psychosis. I'm not asking you to trash Kessler. I never thought those words would come out of my mouth, but go ahead.
There's a bunch of trashing all over the internet of this entire case, and the problem is that people are not educated enough to speak on this.
Did I ask you about the internet? No, I did not. The internet is very often a cesspool. Don't swim in it.
Yes.
Psychosis. How do I know the difference in postpartum psychosis and postpartum depression? That is the key to this case. I'm not saying she's guilty or innocent. I'm trying to find the truth. And trashing the other guests and cursing is not helping anything. Go ahead.
Postpartum psychosis is not the same as psychosis. Postpartum psychosis is an extreme emergency where hormones are dropping out of your body and you have weeks before you're going to do something so drastic like kill your children. If you got shot in the stomach, you'd be in the emergency room and you wouldn't check yourself out because you had a horrible doctor. It's the same thing. She was not taken seriously and she was trying to find help repeatedly. She had intrusive thoughts of hurting herself and her children. They moved into auditory command hallucinations and delusions, and it ended in an altruistic filicide where she thought that she was saving the lives of her children by killing them. It was a failure of the system and education and knowledge all around in everyone, including her husband.
Dr. Leslie Dobson, at any juncture, did she state she thought she was saving the children by killing them?
Yes, she said, go with God.
I've heard that from other moms that kill their children.
She said, go with God, in quotes, in her civil lawsuit.
Okay. At any juncture, did she state by killing her children, she thought she was saving them?
Yes, she has spelled it out in her civil complaint, as well as the three evaluators who met with her.
She said those words. I felt that's my way of saving them. Words to that effect.
Not the exact words of saving them, but it was she described a belief that that she had to save them and protect them by killing them and then killing herself. If she didn't kill herself, she wouldn't be able to then protect them. It's psychotic, delusional thinking.
The difference in this case and many other cases is that she tried to slit her wrists and she jumped out of a window, which indicates she was trying to kill herself. Very often we see killers claim, I wanted to commit suicide, everybody else around them ends up dead and they're perfectly fine. Not in this case. Susan Constantine, this is a concern to me. Women are judged differently in court.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that some may consider her a bad mom is going to weigh against her. They're held to a different, a higher standard when it comes to their children. On the other hand, Susan, in cases, you got three children dead that suffered a horrible death. People search for a motive, which is not required under the law. Translation, it's really hard to convict a mother, even if she is guilty.
Yeah, so that's a really hard thing for the jurors to decide. So for the defense, we're looking for someone that kind of falls in that gray area, you know, where they see that she's was may have had mental illness, right? But then again, did she actually plan it? So then was she cognitive? Was she aware? These are the questions that the jury is going to be asking, because not just because she had mental illness equates to killing your children. There's going to be women that are on that jury that are saying, well, yeah, I had depression. I had a friend that had depression, but they didn't kill their three kids. So, and kind of going back to this is, you know, I was trained by Norv Revis, who actually selected the jury for the Andrea Yates case. Much different case, even though it's very similar, because it was really grounded that she was in psychosis. Okay, right here, we've got ambiguity. And that's exactly what the defense wants. So on the state side, can you have planned it out and still have mental illness? And are they accountable for it? That's what they're going to be weighing back and forth. But I don't think that by having women on the jury, it's going to gain any more sympathy. In fact, it can even be harsher.
You know, Kessler, first of all, can you believe I had to defend you on public airwaves? And against a renowned expert, too, who knows so much more than you and I put together. That's
on that topic.
Kessler, have you ever noticed that women on juries can be harsher on a female defendant? You know what? I think that Constantine is right, because they put themselves in those shoes and they remember how exhausted they were raising their children when they didn't sleep all night, especially if you have twins and one gets up at 12:30, one gets up at 1:30, one gets up at 3:30, one gets up at 5, and everybody's up every single night for basically 2 years. And they think, I didn't kill my children. Or on the other hand, it could work the other way. The justice's case is very, very conflicting with the evidence. But I know you're about to give one H-E-double-L of a closing argument, so have at it.
All right. I think women are always harsher on women in every situation. We do a lot of divorce jury trials here in Georgia, and a lot of women on the jury say, I don't get that much in my divorce. Why should she get that much? I'm making it on my own. Women are much more competitive. Men stick together. And there's a reason psychologists are psychologists and lawyers are lawyers. I can guarantee that psychologist that you had on that the jury is not going to go back into the deliberation room and deliberate and discuss the nuances of psychosis and all sorts of psychological terms. They're going to ask the question, this, did she do it because it was premeditated or why did she do it? And their answer is going to be much less intellectual than the psychologist wants you to believe. Their answer is going to be, she did it because she was crazy. Or she was, there's some other lay term that lay people, like lay jurors, are going to use. That's the only question. And as a lawyer, that's what I need them to think. I don't need them to understand the detailed nuances of this psychosis and that psychosis, postpartum psychosis. I need them to say either she did it because she pre-planned it and she's a murderer, or she did it because she had some mental deficiency and I want to let her off the hook because I think she did it when she was crazy. And that's a lay term. It's not a psychological term. So absolutely, I'm going to be a lawyer and the psychologist can be psychologist, but you're right, Nancy. And since she told me I was right, you're right. Women are tougher on women almost every day in every jury trial.
And to Dr. Leslie Dobson, you have stated that you feel we are mishandling postpartum psychosis, as if we were, quote, back in the 60s. I think I know what you mean by that, but again, it's your expertise, not mine. What did you mean by, like, we're back in the 60s? What does that mean?
I made that comment particularly when the prosecution asked the psychiatrist if Lindsay Clancy had seen a unicorn in the corner. To think that psychosis is seeing unicorns is not only mocking but minimizing the severity of mental illness and our education and understanding of it today. And in particular, and again, I do not agree with the attorney that you've had on. They need to understand, the jury needs to understand the nuance between postpartum psychosis and psychosis. It's not just crazy. It's very different. It's worse than being just crazy.
The evidence very conflicting. I, as normal, think of the victims in this case who had no say in the matter and died a horrible death at the hands of the one person that is supposed to defend them no matter what. What is the answer? That jury will very shortly begin deliberations as we wait to find out if Clancy takes the stand. If you know or think you know anything regarding this case, please dial 781-934-5656. Repeat, 781-934-5656. We remember American hero Deputy Sheriff Carol Scruggs, Marshall County Sheriff's Mississippi, killed in the line of duty, leaving behind four children without their mother. American hero, Deputy Sheriff Carol Scruggs. Thank you to our guests, but especially to you for being with us tonight and every night. Nancy Grace signing off for tonight, but I'll see you tomorrow night. And until then, good night, friend.
This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.